I am simply now going to invite my colleague, Professor Linda Evans, from the School of Education at Leeds University to introduce our keynote this morning to you. Linda is a member of council and also convener of our International Research and Researchers Network, which has taken off brilliantly under her leadership. So she makes an ideal chair for this session. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Helen. I first met our keynote speaker, Georg, 2 years ago in September 2010. I was one of the speakers at an international workshop on higher education management, the professionalisation of higher education management that Georg had organised. And the workshop was held at the German Research Institute for Public Administration in Speyer, where at the time, Georg held the chair for scientific organisation, higher education and science management. And the workshop was a wonderful event. It was well organised with Germanic precision. It was intellectually stimulating, wonderful company. And this was my first visit to Germany, and Georg was an excellent host. On the first evening, he took all the speakers to a restaurant that was renowned for its very fine German wines. And it was there that I discovered that he is actually a wine connoisseur. In fact, in his spare time, I was told, he actually teaches classes on wine appreciation and wine tasting. When I met Georg a few months ago in Berlin at a conference that marked Ulrich Teichler's 70th birthday, Georg had moved jobs by then. He had, in fact, taken over Ulrich's directorship of the International Centre for Higher Education Research at Kassel, what we know as INCHA Kassel, where he is Professor of Higher Education. Now, this is Georg's first visit to SRH conference. I do hope it won't be his last. In fact, I look forward to developing links with INCHA Kassel and the International Research and Researchers Network. Georg is internationally recognised for his research into higher education, and many of you will know his work. He has been visiting professor at Sciences Po and a visiting scholar at Stanford University. He's the author of 3 monographs, 7 edited books, and numerous peer-reviewed journal articles. Today, we're going to hear him talk about empowering universities, contemporary transformations, and unintended outcomes. Georg, I fear that you may find yourself as a wine connoisseur rather disappointed this evening by the wine that you have at the conference dinner. I don't think it will be quite what you're used to. It might be a little bit disappointing, but I hope one thing that doesn't disappoint you is the welcome that you've received here at the SRHE conference. We're absolutely delighted to have you. Colleagues, please join me in welcoming Professor Georg Krücken.
I'm already there. Well, thank you so much, Linda, for these kind words. I enjoyed the wine here very much, both yesterday and the night before. We have a wonderful wine list here in our resort. Thanks to Helen, who brought me here and who also brought me to these restaurants. And, well, I hope I will live up to your expectations with my keynote speech right now. When I was asked whether I would like to deliver a keynote speech for this conference, I was hesitant a little bit because I was wondering whether I would be the right person to address, like the motto is, shared and contested ambitions in higher education. But I thought I have a take on that which might fit in nicely, because I won't talk so much about the changing ambitions, but instead rather on the changing means of how to achieve these goals and ambitions. And let's say my main story here is that we see more and more increasingly higher education as something to be managed, the university also as a managed organization, and this obviously has some impacts. And I will tell you that these impacts are sometimes not the intended one. They produce a lot of unintended consequences for both higher education organizations and society. So this is kind of my general line here. What I would like to do is to focus first on, let's say, broader transnational trends in higher education, in society, governance, and organization. And I will particularly focus on the organizational level, the empowerment of the organization, because I think this is something very salient over the last years in very different national settings. I briefly come then to the question, what does this imply for the management of higher education? And in the second part, I will, with some examples from my German context, show what unintended consequences might result from the idea that the three missions of the universities can be managed directly. And in the end, I will come up with some research perspective, both theoretical and comparative. So if we take a look at the kind of contemporary transformations, obviously there are many different stories, but my stories are rather that we see at the macro level a kind of increasing inclusion in higher education. We see new forms of university governance, and at the organizational level, we see the universities increasingly as organizational actors. Let me start with a first kind of general transnational trends. And I think inclusion is at least one thread to use in order to make sense of changes or transformations in higher education. There are obviously other ones. One could have started also with kind of changing technological conditions or changing economic conditions. I thought inclusion might perhaps be a better starting point, because as compared especially to changing technological conditions, this is a kind of long-term historical and sociological trend we can witness. So obviously there is a kind of ever-increasing inclusion of persons into higher education, into the university system. Just to show you some figures from colleagues of mine from the United States, John Meyer and Evan Schofer, on the tertiary enrollment per capita, per 10,000 capita. Regional averages, regional means here regional in terms of a globalized or world society. And you can see that apart perhaps from sub-Saharan Africa, there's a kind of rapid increase in higher education in tertiary enrollment especially after 1945. Then the second wave was kind of the opening of the higher education systems in the early 70s, and what they cannot describe here, because data only go until 2000, what has happened in the last 10 to 12 years, because the last 10 to 12 years, we can witness another expansion of higher education and another and more stronger inclusion of persons into the system. Just to mention one, give you one example from my country, from Germany. When 10 or 12 years ago, the OECD came up with this 40% benchmark, 40% students of one age cohort being higher education students, nobody could believe that. Nobody could believe that. For some, it was a kind of utopia. For perhaps more traditional professors, it was a kind of dystopia. But nobody could believe 40% enrollment rate in Germany. This was impossible. We are now at 53%. So it really accelerated over the last years. And if you take a more historical perspective, I think it is remarkable the kind of equal ratio of female and male students in higher education. If you take the long history of universities into account, it's a process which started in the late 19th century. Again, if you take the long history, it's a remarkable story that we now in all OECD countries have men and women basically on an equal par in higher education. It is also, we see also obviously a strong inclusion with regard to social class, but here the inclusion is certainly not as strongly, not as perhaps egalitarian as with regard to gender issues. In Germany, for example, the probability to go to university is five times higher if one of your parents has a university degree. So there is still strong inequality with social concerning social class, but nevertheless we see a strong trend of inclusion. And one might think of Martin Tros' book, or a book which was edited lately, which was called Higher Education from Elite to Mass to Universal Higher Education. Correspondingly, we see an increase of subjects of study, which this is also remarkable because a traditional university only had four subjects. Nowadays, we have hundreds of subjects. Even at individual universities, they offer hundreds of courses. This has to do in Europe with the Bologna process, because the Bologna process opened up a variety of bachelor and master courses. Before I came here in the tram in Hamburg, I saw a BA in coffee management. You might get a university degree on coffee management nowadays. But I think, again, it's a kind of long-term historical trend of the academization of society. It started with the inclusion, for example, of engineering in the late 19th century in the university studies, also business studies, journalism. They were all included kind of late 19th century, early 20th century. And more recently, we have, for example, the whole health sector is becoming something that, apart from medicine, that was always there, but apart from medicine, also the kind of health professionals are increasingly part of the higher education of the university system. So, and a third thing in which we find a strong trend towards inclusion is concerning the missions of university. The traditional missions of universities, and here I would limit myself especially to research universities, is going back to the von Humboldtian, ideal roughly 200 years ago, namely doing teaching and research, or research and teaching. And so these are the twin missions of the research universities, which became the twin missions basically in all research universities in the world. And it's interesting that with research and teaching, the link to society, and economy for me is part of society, obviously, the link to society is indirect. We educate, we do research, but whether this will benefit or not society at large, or the economy in particular, is something we can sort out only afterwards. And therefore, something came in which was called a third academic mission, that means direct links to society and the economy, while research and teaching traditional were indirect contributions, indirect missions to be accomplished. But also other missions came up over the last years. For example, in Germany, and I know it also in Sweden or in the United States, many universities are spearheading a trend towards sustainable development. You can see many more missions coming up, what universities are supposed to do instead of the kind of traditional twin mission of doing teaching and teaching or education and research. So let me now come to the governance level. I make it very brief, the role, and again, this is a transnational trend. Here I focus in particular on Europe, because Europeanization is a process to take place in Europe, but the other processes take place also in other continents and other contexts. The role of the state certainly is changing. I won't agree with my colleagues who say the changes as the state is losing in importance. I think we can certainly not say this for most national systems, but the role is changing. It's more kind of a indirect steering through evaluations, through performance-based measurements, and so on. We have an increase of actors, university boards, accreditation and evaluation agencies, but also the media play a stronger role, business plays a stronger role, and so on and so on. Europeanization and competition, Europeanization obviously at the European level. Interestingly, the Europeanization with regard to the educational side of higher education came later as compared to the research side. So there were always European research policies already going back to the 1950s and 60s with regard to the educational side. This came later. And obviously, competition is also kind of, seeing competition as a kind of governance mechanism is something relatively new in higher education, though, as we all know as academics, the academic field is a highly competitive one. So now I would like to come to the third level of changes. I first started with societies and briefly governance, and now the organization, because this is the level of change I would like to focus in particular on, also in the second part of the presentation when I give you some examples from the German case. Briefly, I think everybody knows this, but I would like to briefly go through it. The traditional view of the university as an organization is very different from what we know from other organizations, be it business organizations or public administrations. We have traditionally a strong role of the academic profession and the state. The organizational structure is internally fragmented. And that's why American researchers coined it, or American Swedish researchers coined it, organized anarchies already in the 1970s. And there is a relatively limited role of leadership in higher education due to the strong role of the academic profession and the state and the internal fragmentation of the entity. Against this backdrop, I think we can see a change in the perception of what a university as an organization is. And I think here there's a term empowerment makes a lot of sense, because a university as an organization is going to be empowered. It is less the kind of loosely coupled systems ideal. It is an idea where leadership and hierarchies play a stronger role, both kind of at the central level and at the decentral level through deans, for example. Accountability in academia is traditionally an individualized account. As an academic, I'm typically accountable for my individual achievements. But nowadays, my individual achievements are seen as part of what the organization is doing, which is a certain change in attitude towards the relation between academics and the organizational environment. Third, universities increasingly formulate specific organizational goals and missions. And this is a relatively, I supervised a PhD thesis on mission statements in German universities. That's a relatively recent phenomenon, because traditionally the university, in a sociological sense, it's an institution. An institution in the sociological sense is something you do not reflect on. You just act upon, it is taken for granted. It is taken for granted what a university does, namely research and teaching. Nowadays, you have to be more precise, you have to be more specific. You cannot say we are a university and everybody knows what it is, an entity where you do research and teaching, but you have to formulate more specific organizational goals and missions. Related to that is that we see in the universities nowadays a much more differentiated and a much more elaborate formal structure, especially formal administrative structure. These are trends which are kind of transnational or to be observed at a global level. And here I would like to give an example from a PhD thesis by Daniel Locke from Oxford University. And she organized organizational charts, which is a very interesting phenomenon to analyze organizational charts and to see how organizational changes are reflected in the organizational charts. According to Daniel Locke, in 1920 at Oxford University, there was only one administrative position, namely the accountant. That was, according to her analysis, and she got all the material, that was the only kind of legitimate administrative position. Nowadays, you have 16 units with diverse subunits. You have units like estates directorate, personal services, occupational health services, and so on and so on, which make it very clear that that we are moving towards a very, very differentiated and elaborate formal structures in university. And related to that is, but I shouldn't talk that much about it because there are a lot of people who have done research on that, Celia Whitchurch and others who are here, I guess, on university management as a profession, because university management is again seen as a profession. So the question now is, what does this imply for the management of higher education? And here I would like to take again a more kind of historical and comparative perspective. I think there are important parallels but also differences to early industrial management. If you go back to the history of early industrial management, for example, the volume by Alfred D. Chandler, also the two major volumes by Alfred D. Chandler on US industry, but there are similar works on European business and Japanese business, they show kind of consistently that between the kind of mid-19th century and early 20th century, we had a growth in the in industrial firms and an increasing complexity of industrial firms. So, and this led, so to say, to a split between the owners and the managers. The managerial role came up because the firms were so big and the environments, the internal and external environments of these firms became so complex that the owners could no longer manage their business, and so a whole new field emerged, namely the field of managers. And I think there's an interesting parallel here with regard to what we can witness in higher education over the last, let's say, roughly two decades, because we have a system dynamics which also leads to more higher education management. The systems dynamics is, I think, rather similar. We have an increasing complexity, both the internal complexity and the external complexity of the organization is increasing, and this leads to an increase in higher education management. Think about the increasing uncertainties, but also opportunities for funding. Think about the diversity of the student body, and so on and so on. Internationalization, this is a kind of system dynamics embedded in kind of broader societal trends, which leads to higher education management. And I would like to give you, but they are similar, I'm sure there are similar results from other countries. Just from Germany, we conducted some research and we asked the heads of the university administration in what areas within your university administration have new full-time positions for administrative personnel and new organizational units been established during the last 5 or 10 years. And we can see, especially over the last 5 years, we have much more full-time positions for administrative personnel and much more new organizational units. Think about the whole area of student services, but also rather new areas. Quality assurance of teaching. This was something that was not existent when I was a student. Quality assurance of teaching. Public relations, one of the big winners. Research management, also something that is relatively new, that we have units for research management. And what is also interesting, the president's office is also getting bigger and bigger and more important over time. So here I think there are the parallels to kind of early industrial management with regard to what happens in higher education and concerning higher education management. What I see as a difference, we might discuss it anyhow, is that universities are professional organizations. That means universities, in universities, specific and complex labor processes are carried out. That means the labor processes, and the labor processes are obviously teaching and research, are different from the kind of more standardized, mechanical, simple labor processes in business firms. Correspondingly, the role of the workers, especially the role of the professoriate, is a different one. The status is much higher, and the distribution of power within a university is also different. As I said, especially the professoriate has the professoriate which carries out or at least big parts of these kind of complex and specific labor processes have a much higher status in the university, and therefore the distribution of power is different from the distribution of power in an industrial firm where kind of the new managers take over. As I will show you later, the new higher education managers have only a very limited power base as compared to academics. And so this is kind of the broader story, and I would like now to focus on three examples from the German case, three examples on the three missions, namely the mission of research, and I would like to focus briefly on attempts to foster research excellence at German university. Secondly, the mission of teaching, and I would like to focus on what happens to quality management in teaching. And thirdly, the third academic mission, here as exemplified through technology transfer. And I will show you with all these three examples that we have a kind of more managed ideal I don't know whether I have it, but let's say in the broad environment, there is this ideal of a more managed organization, which leads to kind of unintended consequences we might reflect on. So let me start off with the first example, which is on research, unintended consequences of empowerment. I would like to take the German Excellence Initiative as an example. Maybe some of you have heard of it. It's more than 2.6 billion euro are spent on different initiatives by universities. It's federal money and it's state money. We have a federal system, so it took a long time till, let's say, the federal state and the individual states could agree on that. But more than 2.6 billion euros are put into the universities in order to strengthen high-quality research at German universities. This is done according, following three lines. So to say, the lowest line is graduate programs, PhD programs. Then you have research clusters, and the third line is that also individual universities are promoted as universities which are particularly strong when it comes to research excellence. By the way, the way the whole initiative is phrased is following a kind of traditional science push model. It is not driven, let's say, by economic competitiveness, and business has nothing to say in these kind of evaluation processes. It is more a science push model. The idea, obviously, there is some economic rationale behind it, but the idea is we have to invest hugely into science and research in order to gain, let's say, economic and societal benefits later, because basic research at a high level is important for the economy. What is interesting is that we can see, and there's an analysis by Richard Münch, that we can see with this excellence initiative, we see the strengthening of the authority of disciplinary elites. Because the disciplinary elites, they do the peer review. They basically distribute the money, or they make proposals on how to distribute the money. There's a rather contested analysis by Richard Münch in Germany. I think there are parallels to the research assessment exercise. I recently read a paper by Ben Martin and Richard Whitley. Ben Martin is as a former director of SPRU, and Richard Whitley from Manchester Business School. They are not, let's say, they are not against evaluations in principle, not at all, but they are very critical also about the research assessment exercise, saying this leads to a strengthening of the authority of disciplinary elites, and with the Excellence Initiative, I would like to talk about, we have a similar tendency in the German context. What we also can see is that with the Excellence Initiative, as management is getting ever more important, and you can only be successful in the Excellence Initiative if you have relatively good management capabilities, a kind of loosely structured academic network won't help. You need strong management capabilities and facilities. And what we can see here is that we can see a growth of the research units. The money is typically given to larger research units, and this could lead to very critical effects. Because on the one hand, and I quote here this wonderful historical and sociological work by J. Rogers Hollingsworth, an American who worked on biomedical research, and a younger colleague of mine, Thomas Heinze, and they can clearly show that the productivity, but also the creativity, goes down if the research groups are getting larger. So there's a premium for larger groups, but the kind of more productive unit and the more creative units are the smaller ones. And so one might hypothesize, as an unintended consequence, that both, namely the strengthening of the authority of disciplinary elites and the growth of research units, might have a critical effect on the creativity and innovation in research. If you know a little bit about, let's say, history and philosophy of science, Thomas Kuhn and others, it is very obvious that some ideas which are not developed within a dominant paradigm represented by scientific or disciplinary elites will have a harder time as compared, let's say, to high-class but mainstream research. Another unintended effect is that we see increasing tensions between research and teaching orientations, between and within our universities. It might be an intended effect to see this difference, this increasing gap between more research-oriented universities and more teaching universities. This might be intended, the kind of stratification in the system, but it is certainly not intended that we see that within universities. So a lot of professors who are involved in the Excellence Initiative, they only have a teaching load of 2 to 4 hours, while the traditional professor, by law in Germany, has 8 to 9 hours. And so this creates a lot of strains within departments and within universities, I guess strains that were typically not intended when 2.6 billion euro were spent to foster high-class research. And the last, perhaps not unintended consequences that we can see, and we might debate it. I find it quite positive. Some of my colleagues find it critical that we can see a strengthening of practices of collective competitiveness among academics. I think this is particularly true for people like me in the social sciences or people in the humanities. In the natural sciences and in engineering, there was already, in many fields, already a sense of collective competitiveness, while we were more seen as kind of individual monads. And nowadays, if you want to create a research cluster, for example, in the social sciences, you have to learn collective competitiveness. And collective competitiveness is not something anthropologically given. It has to be learned. It's a learned process. So we are learning these kind of collective competitiveness. Let me come to my second example of unintended, and here I would rather focus on indirect consequences of the empowerment of the university as a managed organization. And here I would like to focus on teaching. I would like to use the growth of quality management units in Germany as an example. As I have shown you before with this slide, when we interviewed the heads of the administration, there was a strong growth of quality management units in German universities over the last years. And it is a nice example for, let's say, my kind of broader story that we can see a transformation of the universities from a loosely coupled organizational structure to a more strategic and integrated organization, because quality management links these different parts and actors within the university. But the direct influence on the teachers, on the teaching of professors they can exercise is very, very limited. And it is also very limited, and this is a kind of interesting variable one should take into account when you do international comparisons, it is also limited by the constitution. In Germany, freedom of research and teaching is part of our constitution. It is a basic right in the constitution. And as a constitutional court is composed of high-class legal scholars, university professors, all of them, you can be sure that they will certainly defend this basic constitutional rights of university professors and other researchers and teachers in academia. So the power they can exercise is only intermediated through university leadership and deans. They don't, hardly have any kind of direct contacts to those who are teaching in academia, but they could exercise some influence through university leadership and deans, typically by the provision of information, but not by the decision-making itself. That's also interesting because in sociology we define power as a capacity to make collectively binding decisions, which includes also non-decisions. They typically don't have the capacity to make collectively binding decisions. You can provide information, which might be a form of soft power, I don't know, but the decision-making rests with other, namely with university leadership and deans. And this is very different from what a manager can do in an industrial firm, obviously, because management has to do with collective decision-making. Here you can prepare a decision, but not carry out the actual decision itself. Here come different perceptions of university leadership come into play, and we have a research project on that, and there are others, Linda, for example, who also work on these issues, like different perceptions of university leadership. Obviously, the influence of the quality managers varies whether you have a perception of the university president or the vice presidents as being a first among equals, That is, the major commitment is to the academic community. Here you are first among equals, or whether you see yourself as a top level of a managerial decision-making system. We have interview data, and there's a huge variance. There's a huge variance. You have university directors who see them more as part of the academic community, who take it as a kind of part-time job to become a university president, and others who see themselves more as a top level of a managerial decision-making system. By the way, we correlated these data with success in the Excellence Initiative, and we didn't find any kind of clear relations. We have universities which are doing very, very well in the Excellence Initiative following the first model, and we have universities which are doing very, very well in the Excellence Initiative following the second model. Okay, I now come to my third and last point concerning unintended consequences of empowerment of the way how the missions and the visions of what a university is carried out. I would like to come to what is called the third mission, namely the kind of direct links to society in general and to the economy in particular. I would like to focus on technology transfer at German universities as an example. I have done some research on that. And I think it is it's embedded in a kind of broader global trend, because technology transfer, and there are a lot of studies on that, in very, very different national systems, is increasingly seen as an organizational responsibility and no longer as something that is mainly a voluntary individual activity. The OECD obviously is always, as usual, instrumental in this regard, but you shouldn't underestimate also the power of academics, for example, social scientists, also here in the UK, in fostering this idea that technology transfer is becoming a third academic mission. Again, if we go back to Germany, we can see there is a lot, historically, there has been a lot of voluntary individual activity, a lot of direct links between university professors and industry. The spectacular growth of the German pharmaceutical industry and the German chemical industry at the end of the 19th century cannot be explained without taking into account these kind of informal contacts between academia and industry. But again, what is interesting now, it is seen more as an organizational responsibility, and increasingly technology transfer units, organizational units at the university level are being set up. This might have unintended and problematic consequences for academic research. I'm referring here, not to quote sociologists all the time, the first couple are economists, the latter is a philosopher of science. And also from an economic point of view, it might result in unintended consequences, because the basic function in the overall innovation system of university is to provide basic open research which can be utilized by everybody. And there are a lot of concerns about serious economists like Mowry and Sampert, for example, who say it might dry out and it might be detrimental to the kind of industrial competitiveness or national competitiveness here of the USA if more and more of this research is done at the interface between university and industry, if we have an increase in patents, if university researchers are distracted from basic research because that's what they are best at, and in several fields you still need a heavy dose of basic research in order to carry out basic innovations.